The following program is brought to you by Whiteman TV and Bruce Telecom.
Baseball Talk is brought to you by Lasting Memories Locker Room, downtown Hanover, where you will find incredible sports memorabilia, art supplies, and custom framing. Check them out online at lastingmemorieslockerroom.com. Well, good evening and welcome to Baseball Talk on 91.3 FM Blue Water Radio and on Whiteman TV. I'm Steve Fitzsimmons along with Andy Clark, as always, in the studio, and we've got a great show lined up for you. Coming on in just a few moments is the MVP of the Inter-County Baseball League, the top league of baseball in Canada, Sean Riley. He'll be with us in just a moment. We're also going to talk Major League Baseball playoff races, and we're going to discuss the greatest managers in Blue Jays history. So we'll bring on Sean Riley of the Kitchener Panthers with us right now. Sean, good evening. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
We're really well, thank you, and appreciate your time coming on. And we want to talk about your career and about the Inter-County Baseball League. And let's go all the way back to 1995 when the Minnesota Twins selected you in the 29th round of the 1995 draft. Can you take us through that experience of being drafted, and did you kind of have an inkling that you would be drafted?
Baseball back then is a lot different than it is now. Obviously, you hear rumors that you might get picked here and there, but you never really know for sure, especially being a Canadian kid coming from a small town. But, I kind of had an idea that I would be taken. I figured it would be probably either the Blue Jays or the Twins. They seemed to have the most interest in me, and it just happened to be that I was drafted on the second day by the Minnesota Twins. So I was pretty excited about it.
Yeah, you were drafted 800th overall in the draft, and you ended up playing a couple of seasons in the low minors in the Gulf Coast League, and you were drafted actually as a pitcher, and now you're an incredibly prolific hitter, the greatest hitter in a lot of people's minds in the history of the Inter-County Baseball League. You've had four MVPs and a triple crown this year for the third time. But take us back to developing as a pitcher, and suddenly later in your career, you're now a hitter.
Yeah. I was always a decent hitter growing up, but obviously being a left-handed pitcher, in Canada at the time, that was usually where, if you're going to make it to the next level, that's where your shot would be. But, in the back of my mind, I always loved hitting, and I knew maybe if pitching didn't work out, I'd maybe like to try to get back to that. It was hard being in the minor leagues because as a pitcher, I never got to pick up a bat. It was probably 5 years in between at bats in any organized league. So, that was tough. Trying to adjust when I came back, I kind of had an arm injury as a pitcher and then slowly just kind of transferred back into a hitter.
And once you got back into the hitting, you obviously did extremely well, hitting both for average and for power. Did you ever reach a point where you went back and tried to work your way into pro ball, or had you moved on in your life with work and other things, or how did that story play out?
It was a different time back then. I was still a young kid when I got back, and, the opportunities that, the Canadians have now weren't what they were back then. There's a lot more independent leagues for people to get released to kind of go and then kind of resurrect their career. And, I was kind of happy where I was in life, and, I just kind of wanted some time off to enjoy being a kid, because really, my late teens were spent, touring the States and riding buses. So I just kind of wanted to enjoy being a kid and, join some time with my family when I got back, and then kind of see where that went.
Sean, you kind of alluded to it a little bit, and some of our other guests have as well, especially ones that are Canadians that have played in the U.S., about a bit of a learning curve when you can't play baseball 365 days a year in Canada just on the weather basis. Was it tough to go down to the U.S. and compete against guys that were playing year-round?
Oh, absolutely. I signed my first pro contract when I was 17 years old. So, and I was a young 17 as well. So when I got down there were guys that, I had baseball cards of that I was collecting, a year or two before that. So it was kind of surreal in that fact. And a lot of these guys were absolute men. 250 pounds, full beard, hitting balls 500 feet. And, here I am, basically some kid coming out of Canada trying to compete with these guys. But, it's tough. It's a huge adjustment, especially being in Canada in the winter. All we really had to do was, we had to rent out gyms in Toronto. That's pretty much all we had. I mean, there was no, the facilities didn't exist like they do today. So, I mean, it was tough.
Yeah, there's a lot more infrastructure. And, of course, I think Baseball Canada, and probably with a push from the Toronto Blue Jays, have really helped develop baseball and the infrastructure in Canada.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I mean, when I first got back to the minors, there was a team, I don't know if you're familiar with, the Ontario Blue Jays.
Yes.
And, the Blue Jays really backed them initially. And then from that, I mean, there was a couple players that, you know, had played in that organization, and it kind of opened up their own facilities from that. So it just kind of all taken off. I think they were pretty much the flagship team when it comes to, I don't want to say independent baseball, but just like an elite program, I guess you could say.
Do you remember, I mean, going back to playing those two seasons that you did, and you had 35 innings pitched and you had 36 strikeouts, an impressive number there in 1995-96. And, of course, you alluded to your arm injuries, but obviously you were a power pitcher at that time.
Not really. I mean, I would only top maybe, you know, high 80s, but I had a pretty good curveball. And, I mean, unless you're throwing 95, you pretty much have to hit your spots, and you kind of have to know how to pitch, right? So, I mean, I could always, I always knew how to pitch. I used to watch Jimmy Key growing up, if you can believe that. He was always my favorite pitcher, so I kind of tried to mold myself after him. So I really wasn't a power pitcher. I was more relied on smarts, but, I mean, it is what it is.
Are you a lefty?
Yeah, I'm a lefty.
Sean, I mean, you've played in the Intercounty Baseball League for the last 19 seasons, and this year you broke league record for most career home runs back in the summertime. And I mean, just to give the folks watching and listening kind of a lowdown on your numbers this year, you had 17 home runs in 36 games, 48 RBIs, and you hit .444. That was your regular season, and you won the Triple Crown: most home runs, most RBIs, the best average in the league. I mean, those are phenomenal numbers. Really, in any league, when you prorate it, you must have been excited to replicate what you did in 2015 with the Triple Crown again.
Yeah, I mean, it's exciting, but you know, coming into any season, my goal isn't to win a Triple Crown or win an MVP. My goal is to always win a championship with the rest of my team. But I mean, it's nice, and it's something that, you know, no one can ever take away from me. But in the end, you know, I'm there to win a championship and get a ring. So,
well, you got awfully close this year, Sean. I mean, your team had their best record since 1993, 28-8 in the regular season. You ran up against a juggernaut Barry Baycat's team in the league final. But just your thoughts on the season overall.
I mean, that's just it. I mean, that record and the team we had on in most years would probably win you a championship. It's just unfortunate, you know, we had this team and had to face a team like Barry, who basically were on another level. You know what I mean? That team has stuck together for a while. I think that's their fourth in a row, and, you know, it's going to take something special to knock them off their horse.
You know, you're obviously a very prolific home run hitter. I mean, what does it take to be a very skillful home run hitter? Like, what is it that makes your stroke so successful? Is it just a combination of power and speed?
Well, I think you need to be smart. And as I got older, I became, a smarter hitter. I tried to cut my strikeouts down more. But, I mean, you have to be strong. And I keep myself in shape. You know, I'm at the gym 5 or 6 days a week, which obviously helps. But I think more than anything, it's just because you become a better hitter just as you get older. You learn how to, you know, like when you're facing different pitchers, what pitches to look for. And it just all comes from experience.
So you mentioned there that you keep yourself in pretty good shape to keep the power up. I was reading in, I believe it was The Record, an article where it alluded to, you said about 8 or 9 years ago you got serious about your nutrition. What kind of changes did you make that way?
Well, I mean, I became close to, I wouldn't say absolute retirement, but it had crossed my mind. I mean, I was kind of getting out of shape. Just, you know, I just wasn't feeling myself. And I just kind of one day just made a change and started going to the gym and decided to eat healthy. I mean, don't get me wrong, I still love my McDonald's, but I mean, that stuff, it catches up to you as you get older. So, I mean, more than anything, it's just a diet change and just trying to stay consistent and active.
Now, Sean, in anything that you can see on the internet about you, it talks about your prolific hitting career. But when you came to the Intercounty, like, did you actually pitch at all, or were you always in the, you know, first base, or what was the story there?
Initially, when I came to the league, I was just a pitcher. I started my career with the Hamilton Cardinals, and they weren't doing so well at the time, so I came to them and tried to help them out in the pitching manner. It just happened to be that we had some teams where attendance was kind of an issue, and then I was kind of forced to go in and hit sometimes, and I liked it, and I did well, and then as the years went on, I just became a full-time hitter.
Has it been a while since you've actually made an appearance as a pitcher in the league, or...?
I think the last time I pitched would have been in the 2005 All-Star Game.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you could still do it if you had to?
Oh, I bet I could go out there and get out for about three innings, but then I'd probably be on the shelf for about 3 months. So.
Right. Yeah, not worth it, eh?
Take the winter.
Yeah.
Now, there's been quite a few top-notch Canadian players go through the Intercounty Baseball League. Who would you say some of the toughest pitchers are that you faced as a batter?
Oh, I remember when John Axford was in our league. He threw hard, but he really didn't know where it was going. He didn't have that that control that he does now. There's been a lot. I mean, there's been a lot of great hitters, a lot of great pitchers. Like Chris LaRue was in our league. He threw a little bit. He was more of a catcher, though, when he was with Brantford. I think he was signed as a catcher and then eventually became a pitcher, so I didn't really face him. But, I'm trying to think of some big-name Canadians that have come through. And it's mostly big-name hitters when I think about the Intercounty and ex-Major League guys.
Yeah. How about Spall Jarek? Did you ever face him?
Oh, yeah. How can I forget about Spally? That's right. to be honest, I was, like, hitting off of Spally. He was a guy that challenged you, 0-2. He was still coming right at you. And as a right-handed hitter and him being a left-handed pitcher, I usually used to see him. I'd see him pretty well. But, I still talk to him once in a while, and we joke about things. But he's probably up there as one of the best all-time, for sure.
So, Sean, you're 40 years old. You just came off a tremendous season. How many more years do you think you could possibly play?
Well, you're about the 10th guy to ask me this.
I'm sure.
Question. So, in the offseason, I just take it year by year. I see how I feel, and I'm not one of those guys that if I feel I can't do it anymore, it's just going to continue. But like I said, as long as I stay in shape and, I still have that passion for the game, I could probably go out there and play for another 5 years. But with that being said, I also have a family now and two young kids. And obviously, I'd like to spend some time with them in the summers. But, it's just a decision I make each and every winter.
Can you give us just a sense of the level of play in that league? A lot of people maybe in this particular area and might not be familiar with seeing a live intercounty baseball league game. Would you equate it to like low minor leagues type of thing?
Oh, absolutely. I would say at the bare minimum, when you take the top two teams, you look at the rosters up and down, and a lot of those guys could be playing in Double A and some in Triple A. It's tough. Like I said, the top two teams are kind of on a different level, and then it kind of goes down a little bit. I mean, you might have a couple of players here and there that can still play, but I mean, up and down 1-9 on Barrie. I mean, that's a team that all of those guys can be playing professional baseball still.
So you were a professional pitcher for a couple of years. When you look now at how you've done as a hitter and you think like, do you feel like you could actually go to Double A and actually do well right now as a hitter?
That's a very tough question.
I know. Yeah.
I think I could compete. Whether or not my body can stand up to the grind of a long season like that, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, you're facing pro pitchers each and every day. We're in the Intercounty. You're facing maybe a guy of that caliber once a week or stuff, right? So it's a little different, and I think it would take a little bit of adjusting. But I think I could compete. I don't think I'd look out of place.
What do you take from the mental side of the game? I'm sure your game has evolved mentally over the years about with experience on how to handle sort of the ups and downs of baseball.
Yeah, I mean, confidence has always been a huge thing for me, and I think that had a lot to do with my success. I mean, every time I come to the ball field, I believe I'm the best player there, whether or not I am or not. And sometimes that's the difference between a 1-for-5 game and a 3-for-5 game. Because, I mean, baseball is a game of failure. I mean, it's tough enough going out there and trying to get one hit every three at-bats. But, I mean, if you don't have enough confidence in yourself, you're just making it harder.
Well, more often than not, you've been the best player on the field, so that's working for you pretty well. I just wanted to ask you about the Guelph Royals are back in your league. They just were purchased. Actually, the mayor is part owner. The mayor of Guelph is the part owner in that franchise. Just your thoughts on them rejoining the league. They've been obviously a franchise in that league for a long time.
I mean, it's awesome. I'm real excited for them, and hopefully they can come and get back to where they used to be. I actually played in Guelph for a number of years, probably 8 years. You know, I had some of the best memories of my life playing for this city. So, you know, I'm confident that they're going to get back. It seems like they've got good ownership and some sponsorship that's already eager to get involved. And, you know, that's what it's all about, just putting a good product on the field. And when you do that, the fans are going to come back.
I wanted to ask you, going back to your childhood, what was it that first drew you into the game? How did you develop that passion for baseball? And how did that lead you to being drafted? What was the pathway to the draft?
I mean, I used to watch, you know, the baseball games with my dad, and I remember, I think it was 84 when the Jays were playing the Tigers, I believe, and, you know, that epic collapse by Toronto. You know, I kind of started taking interest in that, and then as I get older, obviously, you know, I used to love, like, George Bell and the Fred McGriffs, and then obviously they went on to get very, very successful and win a couple World Series, and everything just kind of blossomed there. I mean, the interest in Canadian baseball in general just kind of blew up.
Wondering your thoughts on the baseball record you set this summer for the most career home runs in the Intercounty Baseball League, your pride in that particular record.
To be honest with you, that's a record I thought would never be broken. The guy I passed, Randy Kerr, and I actually had played against when I was just getting in the league, and he was just finishing up. I probably actually gave up a couple home runs to him, to be honest. He was a big boy, and I mean, anybody that follows the Intercounty knows who he is, and I mean, it's I'm pretty proud to pass a guy like Randy.
Sean, you're obviously around the game in Canada. When you look at the state of Canadian baseball now versus when you started out, is it really night and day in terms of where we're at now versus where we were?
Oh, absolutely. And the opportunities for these kids coming up now is night and day, as you mentioned. I mean, coming up, I mean, I played for my city, and that's pretty much all there was. I mean, now there's all these elite programs that are taking these kids, you know, touring Florida, playing all the Gulf Coast teams, and, you know, they're just getting the exposure that, you know, that I never had, that I never had those opportunities.
And I guess there's no question that the success, when the Toronto Blue Jays have success, it drives more people to be interested in the game as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the sad thing about, you know, the Toronto fans. It seems they only get interested when they win. But, I mean, it is what it is. I mean, we're a hockey nation, and hopefully, you know, as time goes on, that starts to change. But from what I understand, enrollment's up in a lot of cities, like especially in the Kitchener and Guelph area. So, I mean, that's obviously a good thing.
On our show here, we've talked a lot about some of the greatest Canadian baseball players, and one thing I wanted to get your opinion on was Larry Walker not being in the Hall of Fame, and it's questionable whether he's going to get there, but what's your opinion on whether or not Larry belongs?
I mean, that's also a tough question, right? You look at the numbers and stuff, and it seems he certainly deserves a solid chance of getting there. But, I mean, when you're on that ballot and there's some other big names on there that are putting up those numbers and you know, maybe even slightly bigger, it's just, you know, they can only put in, I think, I'm not sure what the vote is, the percentage, but, you know, like 50% or something like that. But he's just one of those guys that seem to just be on the cusp, and hopefully he, you know, one of these years he gets in. I mean, I think he deserves it.
Sean, when you were growing up, was there a particular baseball player that you kind of looked up to as sort of your idol?
Like I said, growing up being left-handed, I always loved Jimmy Key. You know, when I would fool around with the bat, you know, I always loved George Bell for some reason. I mean, at the time, I think he had just won an MVP. I don't know if that was 87.
It was 87, yep.
Yeah, I think it was 87. And, you know, when I was out in the schoolyard playing, you know, I always wanted to be George Bell when I was hitting, and I always wanted to be, you know, Jimmy Key when I was pitching, so.
No, sorry, And going back, I think I'm referencing the Waterloo Record article again, but you mentioned that you had switched back to a heavier, longer bat right before you got your record-setting home run. What's your general philosophy on the bat? Should you generally try to be going for, you know, the bigger bat, or, you know, the leaner, faster bat? What's your philosophy?
I think it depends on what type of hitter you are, really. I mean, you see some of the you know, the speed sits at the top of the lineup. You're generally probably going to have a lighter bat, and you know, just trying to make contact and put it in play. But, I mean, you look at a guy like Barry Bonds, I think he had a 33.5-inch bat, and he'd choke up. right? So, I mean, it's everybody's different, individual's different, and it's just kind of trial and error what you're most comfortable with.
Yeah, what kind of bat did you prefer?
I mean, I like a bigger bat, but usually if I'm using a bigger bat, I sacrifice a little bit on my average. I mean, I know the numbers obviously don't look like that, but I mean, usually that's what happens. I'll start getting more doubles and home runs, and you know, striking out maybe a little bit more, not putting as many balls in play.
Did you have like a particular type of wood, like ash or maple, or?
This year I was swinging the B45s, which are actually a company out of Quebec. They were a birch, and actually it's the first time in my life I've ever swung them, and I actually enjoyed using them.
I knew a few years ago that the maple was really catching on in the major leagues, but I didn't realize the birch was now in play too.
Yeah, the birch is really coming on, and like I said, I'll still use maple once in a while. I mean, I'll use anything. I'll try anything out. And growing up, I used ash, but I used to swing so hard that unless I hit it on the barrel, I mean, that bat didn't stand a chance.
Sean, a lot of people are familiar with the Toronto Maple Leafs baseball team from your league, and, of course, the very iconic Christy Pitts and Jack Domenico that owns that team. I just wonder your thoughts on playing in that particular venue and you know, the historical aspect to that team being in your league.
Yeah. I mean, I've played for Toronto and I've played against Toronto. I mean, I hated being an opponent there, but I love playing for them. Don't get me wrong. And Jack is Jack's something else. I mean, he's a legend in this league, and you know, I hope he's around for another 20 years. He's great for the league. I mean, he does sponsorship, and I mean, he really is. Like, he's the face of the league. But if anybody knows Jack, he's a funny guy to talk to. Everyone just says it's Jack being Jack, but. Yeah, I mean, Toronto's been a staple, I think, for about 50 years now. I think it's their 50th anniversary next year. But, I mean, anytime Toronto's in the league, they're going to be successful. And, I mean, it looks like they're going to be in the league for a while still.
Well, Sean, you had a tremendous season. Congratulations on that. Continued success moving forward next season as well. And we really appreciate your time.
No, anytime. I appreciate you having me.
Nice talking to you, Sean.
There you have Sean Riley, the Inter-County Baseball League MVP and the Triple Crown winner and the career home run record holder of the Inter-County Baseball League. We'll take a break and be back with more baseball talk right after this.
This is Hope from Whiteman Community TV. Join us on Saturday, September 30th from 9 a.m. till 3 p.m. for the second annual Blue Water Radiothon. The Radiothon will be broadcast live on Blue Water Radio and live on Whiteman TV Channel 1. This year's Radiothon will be in support of the Hanover, Walkerton, and Durham Hospital Foundations. This event is live, interactive, and it's your chance to directly support your local hospital. Local radio, local TV, for local healthcare. Save the date for the Radiothon, Saturday, September 30th, 9 a.m. till 3 p.m.
8 out of 10 people who die in boating incidents are not wearing a PFD. Most people think they're safe just because they have a life jacket or PFD on board. But when something goes wrong on the water, it happens very quickly. There is no time to grab your PFD.
Another tragic drowning.
Wearing a life jacket or PFD will save your life. Please wear it for everybody's sake. You can tell the family they found the body.
Baseball Talk is brought to you by Lasting Memories Locker Room, downtown Hanover, where you will find incredible sports memorabilia, art supplies, and custom framing. Check them out online at lastingmemorieslockerroom.com.
And we're back on Baseball Talk on Blue Water Radio 91.3 FM and Whiteman TV. If you want to catch our show on the television version of it, that's Friday nights at 8 o'clock on Channel 6 on Whiteman Cable. And we're going to bring our man in the booth, Adam Oliveira, into the action and talk about our Twitter poll.
Hey guys, how are you all doing? It's good to be here back in the booth. And we've got a Twitter poll for this week. Let me just go and find it here. Give me one sec. There we go. We were talking about John Gibbons. We're thinking, what do you think of the job manager John Gibbons has done with the Blue Jays this season? So our choices were fantastic season, up and down, or disaster, ditch him now. So there's no surprise here. Fantastic season ended up with only 6%. Disaster was in next, 35%, and that's actually what I picked. And then up and down, 59%. So,
you know, the interesting thing about that is a lot of baseball watchers actually feel that John Gibbons has maybe done some of his best managing in this down season with some of the things he's done. So, you know, some of like Shai Davidian type people like that, I think, you know, have had that school of thought.
And certainly with, you know, Justin Smoak having a supreme season, he's obviously set the conditions where that can happen. And some of those young players have done really well, like Marcus Stroman. But I know we've also been a little bit critical of how he's handled people like Osuna. And
yeah, I certainly wasn't saying that I was sharing that opinion. I was just saying there is a school of thought of people that feel that way.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not surprising that there's a portion of that.
Yeah, and then there's always those dynamics. People say, well, there's the injuries. But at the same token, Cleveland Indians have had a huge amount of injuries and went on an unbelievable winning streak. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you can always point the finger at who's putting the talent on the field, right? And I know it was commented to me that people that are starting to panic a little bit about the Jays, they're saying, well, Shapiro, who's the guy in charge, is also the guy who put that Indians lineup together that's doing so well right now. So,
yeah, I mean, there's certainly some confidence from that part of it that he shows in the recent history that he did it on a much smaller payroll, or put the pieces in place, the pieces on the chessboard, if you will, to be successful. And of course, the new general manager of the Cleveland Indians has added to that with Edwin and some other pieces there. But yeah, your point is well made that perhaps we should have confidence in his ability to make some moves. So we're talking about managers with the Twitter poll on what we think about John Gibbons and the job he's done. But let's segue to the best Blue Jay managers in their team history. And so FanRag on the internet had an interesting online voting of this very topic. And so they have the top 15, well, or bottom 15, depending how you look at it, because there hasn't been much more than 15. But they have a ranking from 1 to 15 on the voting from online folks that on how they feel. So who do you think would be number one? I mean, if just...
Adam and I were speculating before the show, and everyone loves Cito. So.
And it is Cito Gaston. Yeah. And I mean, you know, yes, he was... the media was hard on him at times, I think, versus how the performance of the team was. But at the end of the day, he has two World Series rings and was the most successful manager in their club history. And at the end of the day, you know, he had a very successful run. And we forget, too, that Cito, of course, was the manager two different occasions for the Toronto Blue Jays. His first run, 681, 635 with a 517 win percentage. And then, of course, more recently, 2008 to 2010, he was 211 and 201 for a 512 win percentage. But very consistent. I mean, at times he had a lot of talent to work with. At other times, not as much.
And, you know, he was a really classy guy, too. He conducted himself well on the field. When I remember watching him in that first run when they won the World Series championships, he was, respectful to the umpires and the other team there. You never really saw him, like, bust out like Gibbons does and get in the face of the umpire and try and argue a call. You know, he maybe done that once or twice, but he usually backed off and they didn't have to, you know, eject Cito from a game. I don't think there was very few games where Cito was ejected, right?
No, I don't think there was that type of... I don't know what you would say, disrespect between Cito and the umpires on a lot of occasions. He went out to argue some calls, but you're right. I think he was pretty calm in his demeanor in dealing with them, for sure.
And certainly I don't remember, with Cito in charge, having some games where I felt that maybe an umpire was carrying a bit of a grudge, too. And what leads me to say that is this season, there's been a few times where I felt, for instance, when Pilar... when he, a few weeks ago, jogged by, and there was very little opportunity for him to say anything, and he got kicked out of the game. And it felt like the umpire was just waiting for an opportunity to toss them. And we had that game previous where Stroman and Martin and the manager were all thrown out lickety-split with very little. So I kind of feel sometimes because of the demeanor of Gibbons that maybe there's a little bit of a grudge by some umpires.
That certainly could be the case. So FanRag voters voted Cito Gaston number one. So let's speculate on who you think might be number two in the history of Blue Jay managers.
Ooh. You know, if it was up to me, I'd almost go Fregosi, but I don't know if that would actually be on the poll. I'd think maybe
he's in there, but he's not number two.
I'd say Bobby Cox would be number
two. And you would think that too, yeah. But he's actually number three. It's John Gibbons actually is ranked
as
number two.
Okay.
So, you know, and when we look at John Gibbons' numbers, he's 250 and 236, a 514 win percentage. He's had some success, but I wouldn't have considered him in the top three or four of managers, and maybe that's just a timely sort of thing where people know him so well because he's the manager right now. And, you know, if you like him and you like what he's done, you vote for him versus maybe not having seen some of the other managers manage in the past, you know, depending on your age. So I wonder if that skews the poll a little bit that way.
Definitely a time factor. And when it comes down to it, there only have been three managers in Blue Jays history that have any postseason experience.
Right.
And he being one of the three of them. So
absolutely.
Yeah, and if he was just the manager for just this season, he'd probably be way down at
like
the very
15th,
bottom.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
He did have like a couple of good runs in his career so far with the Blue Jays, bringing them to the postseason a couple of times. So he's got to be high up there.
So why don't I go down the poll for you on the order, and then we'll kind of talk about something that kind of stands out to you. So Cito number one, John Gibbons number two, Bobby Cox number three, Jim Fregosi number four, Bobby Maddock, of course, we go way back with the Toronto Blue Jays for him, number five, Buck Martinez number six, Roy Hartsfield, the first Blue Jays manager, number seven. Jimmy Williams, number eight. Gene Tennis, who really was a fill-in manager at times, not really a full-time manager, at number nine. Cookie Rojas, who actually was a lot of times basically pitched to the fungo bats, you know, in warm-up, was like the first base coach and stepped in a few times. And he's number 10.
He only managed officially three games.
I know. But he was known for, you know, dealing with the fungo bats, hitting out balls out in the outfield for the outfields. But anyway, he's number 10. So that's where we've got to. But
okay,
so it's funny who's below him, actually, is the funny part.
Well, okay, because if you're going to get into, you know, people who have less than 10 games of managing, then why isn't Mel Queen? The guy had an 800 winning percentage.
Well, he's number 12. So.
Okay. Yeah.
So we have Cookie at number 10. Harry Warner, who I don't even remember actually at all, at number 11. Mel Queen at 12. Carlos Tosca, number 13. And rounding out the top 15, Tim, I Didn't Lie, Johnson at number 14. And John Farrell, the manager of the Boston Red Sox today, at number 15, and I wonder if there's a lot of spite behind that particular. John Farrell was not a bad manager for the Toronto Blue Jays, but, you know, I think people sort of look at him as the evil enemy now when he's the manager of the Boston Red Sox.
They're pretty angry that he left.
I think so.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because some of those names like Bobby Maddock and Roy Hartsfield you mentioned, those guys have like winning percentages of in the 300s, like 327, 388.
But you know what? We have a certain nostalgia about some of the older Blue Jays teams. And of course, those guys were the managers of some of the, you know, the sort of
earliest
late 70s, early 80s teams before Bobby Cox came into the picture. But and so maybe as time goes on, we have a bit more nostalgia with those guys, even though the performance on the field was pretty subpar.
And they get a little bit of a free pass in the aspect of having that expansion team. Tim Johnson, who obviously, you know, no one's going to condone the fact that he lied on his resume.
But his record's good.
And his record was good, actually, in the 162 games. He had a 543 winning percentage, which is
88 and 74.
Pretty much, for anyone who was there for any duration, is the best winning percentage.
Bobby Cox is the only one with a bigger, higher win percentage, 355 and 292 for a 549 win percentage in the 82 to 85 that he managed the Toronto Blue Jays. So at the end of the day, like, you know, that 1 year was a real good one. It's just unfortunate he didn't handle things the proper way. But he was actually a good manager.
Yeah. And, you know, the one I think gets understated a little bit is Jimmy Williams, who, you know, he came in under Bobby Cox. He was one of his guys and then took over after that. But he got in 522 games and 538 winning percentage. So they were
on
still
some
a pretty solid team there.
Yeah, I mean, they were good teams. And I feel like he got quite a bit out of those teams as well. And, you know, all due credit to him for what when we look back in the history of the Toronto Blue Jays, he has to be considered among the top five or six managers ever.
And Jimmy conducted himself well too. Bobby was a bit of a bigger personality, Bobby Cox. Bit of a bigger personality.
Yeah, but, for sure.
And not that Jimmy was quiet, but he was a little more understated. And yeah, I think he's a little bit underrated on our list there.
And you know, I mean, Bobby Cox, when you look at his success with the Toronto Blue Jays, you look at his success with the Atlanta Braves, which he's more known for than being the manager of the Toronto Blue Jays. But, you know, he doesn't have a lot of championships, but those teams, a lot of those teams were playoff teams with Bobby Cox as their manager. And at the end of the day, I think he had maybe just the one World Series ring, if I recall correctly. But
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, how many times did he get to the dance? He got there a lot of times, and through unfortunate circumstances, some injuries, and, you know, just maybe not being the best team at times, being the second best team, I think he was a heck of a manager when you look back at it.
Yeah, difference of the fact that he actually won one, they were kind of like the Buffalo Bills of baseball
because they
went to the World Series or to the National League finals so many times. To only win one of it is a bit of a shame. So you can look at it in that regard of, did he underachieve because he had such great teams? But to stay so consistently good, I think, yeah, he had to be a heck of a manager. And yeah, I remember that was back in those days where they got into that one playoff series with the Jays, and The Americans brought out the Canadian flag upside down.
Yeah, nobody will forget that.
We could do a whole show on just American anthems.
And they missed. Didn't the Braves miss a couple of catches on their road up, or when they were playing the Jays? I remember like a few missed plays during that series too. There was a couple of weird things that happened in that.
Yeah,
series.
there were some things that were kind of a gong show at times in that particular series for sure. Adam, I mean, Adam, when you look through these names that we just went through, I mean, is there somebody that kind of stands out that maybe you think should be higher on the list, or maybe should be lower on the list? Who jumps out at you?
Well, see, that's my problem, is I only really know the coaches from the 90s
in recent history,
on.
Yeah.
So Cito is my coach of choice.
Yeah.
Like, I grew up watching the Jays and, you know, sitting in my parents' basement and glued to the TV and watching them win the World Series kind of cemented Cito into my mind as the coach of choice for the Jays.
You know, the interesting thing, of course, Bob McCowan, everybody knows what a great radio personality he is for the Fan 590 in Toronto, Primetime Sports. He's hosted that for 35 years, and he doesn't have a good thing to say about Cito, which, you know, which kind of rained on Cito's parade, I think, a lot of times. You know, Bob is certainly an impressive radio host, has been for a long time, very popular, and for whatever reason, never liked Cito, and it kind of drove the media narratives at times, I think, with Cito. And with all due respect to Bob McCown, I think somewhat unfairly at times too, where he maybe was picking on Cito, you know, somewhat unnecessarily. But there's no doubt that the media in that case kind of drove the narrative a little bit on Cito.
Yeah, I'd never trust a guy who wears his sunglasses inside while doing a radio show.
Yeah, and obviously he's had a tremendous amount of respect, so have to be careful what I say here. But I did actually, I don't typically listen to a show, but this summer I did listen to while I was driving somewhere, and he spent upwards of 10 minutes, he and one of his partners on the radio program, talking about whether they still carry pocket change or if they only use their debit card for anything. And that covered about 10 minutes on a sports show. And I was like, dudes, you perhaps should have prepared for the show a little bit better. But
yeah, it's probably worth having some show prep to know what you're going to talk about. But you know what? I mean, he's done it for 40 years, and he continues to be Canada's most listened to sports talk presentation. So all the power to Bob McCown. But I disagree with him on that particular opinion that he's had about Cito. I mean, what about Buck Martinez? I mean, he's kind of middle of the pack. You look at his record. We know he didn't really have the greatest team. He had, his record was 99-113 in parts of two seasons. But when we listen and watch him on Blue Jays broadcast, there's no question he's a student of the game. He's very intelligent about it. And, you know, I'm kind of surprised when I look back at it that perhaps he didn't take another run at being a manager.
I'm surprised, too, because you're right. He has wonderful insights. But in some ways, he has a really good gig as a broadcaster.
Right.
So perhaps that was the deciding factor of, he knows he's really excellent at that. He knows where he's going to be. He knows his without the uncertainty, right? Because there's a very short shelf life for most managers in baseball.
Well, yeah, I'd echo those comments. Like, when you listen to a Blue Jays broadcast, you gain so much more from listening to Buck describe the play or what happened. Tiny little things that you'd never pick up as a casual viewer, he's explaining, and he's an excellent broadcaster.
And you know what? I think it speaks to how great a broadcaster he is. When we look back at the playoffs and Fox Sports ended up doing the Toronto Blue Jays playoff games, you know, in the last few years, and there was no Buck Martinez because they took it. And how much did we miss Buck Martinez and crew and Dan Schulman and those guys? Because, I mean, at the end of the day, he does it so smoothly, so professionally. His insights are so in tune with the Toronto Blue Jays in particular, but just in baseball in general. And we realize that he's an elite broadcaster. There's no question about that for baseball.
You realize those times when you wish he was on the radio at that time, so you could mute the darn Fox broadcasters and put the radio on.
Well, we always have the sweetness of Jerry Howarth for that. So,
for sure.
You know. Yeah, he does a great job too.
Yeah, he really does. We're spoiled. If you're Blue Jay fans out there, you're definitely spoiled. Andy, we have a few minutes left. Why don't we talk about some of the races? I mean, the biggest race probably is between... I mean, the biggest race I think that people locally are watching is probably the race between Boston and the New York Yankees in the American League East. The Yankees trailing Boston by 3 games right now. And, I mean, there's such bad blood between those two teams, of course, for the stuff that's gone off the field and on the field recently. With some of the controversy over, you know, the stealing the signs and all that stuff that went on.
I suggest we leave that as a teaser and take our second break, and
sure,
then we'll come on back and we'll talk about the playoff race. We'll do Clark Ives and then talk about the playoff race to round things out.
Sounds like a plan.
So we're going to take a quick break here on Baseball Talk on Blue Water Radio, 91.3 FM and Whiteman TV.
The most music, 91.3.
Baseball Talk is brought to you by Lasting Memories Locker Room, downtown Hanover, where you will find incredible sports memorabilia, art supplies, and custom framing. Check them out online at lastingmemorieslockerroom.com.
Gray Bruce Brick and Landscape Supply in Hanover is this area's leader for all your interlocking stone and retaining wall solutions, including CanRock. They carry a wide selection of Aeriscraft, Permacon, and cultured stone products for all your landscaping projects, as well as clay brick, carrying top quality products including Hansen. Your first choice for landscape, septic, and masonry products. Visit Gray Bruce Brick at 525 First Street in Hanover, 519-364-7778, or visit graybrucebrick.ca. Gray Bruce Brick and Landscape Supply, proudly serving the community for over 50 years.
Bruce and Gray counties are amazing places to live, but sometimes they can be difficult to get around and explore. That's where Soggy Mobility and Regional Transit comes in. Since 1977, they've specialized in public transit service to those with permanent or temporary mental and physical challenges within Bruce and Gray counties. Finally, you have the ability to stay mobile. Life can be challenging. Let Soggy Mobility help. To find out more about smart services in your area or to register, visit soggymobility.ca and they'll see you soon.
Tired of hard water wreaking havoc around your home? Dry skin and lifeless hair? Dull and dingy laundry? Soap scum and spotted glasses too?
Hey, Culligan man! A Culligan water softener turns hard water soft every time. Soft water is the answer. Not cleaning products or detergents. Culligan saves you up to 50% on soaps and detergents while turning your laundry, bathroom, and kitchen brilliant, like me. Hey, Culligan man!
This is Trevor Porter. Join me Saturdays from 3 to 7 p.m. for the Saturday Afternoon Jukebox. Each week, I'll play the greatest hits of the 50s and 60s and pass along fun facts and little-known trivia about the music. You're bound to hear some songs you haven't heard since back in the day. That's the Saturday Afternoon Jukebox with me, Trevor Porter, Saturdays 3 to 7 p.m. right here on 91.3 FM, Blue Water Radio.
And we're back on Baseball Talk on Blue Water Radio, 91.3 FM. And we're going to kick things off first with some Clark Ives here. And the first one we're going to go to is from a Walkerton Herald Times. The year we're going to is 1964. And you can see the headline coming up for our TV viewers that it's the Ingersoll Mets, K.O. Walkerton. And what it recounts here is that it's Ontario Baseball Association Junior B quarterfinals. And it was the best two out of three series. And the Walkerton Merchants, they got some great pitching in the second game from Doug Cassidy, who had he allowed six hits, struck out 11, two walks. But unfortunately, it wasn't enough for Walkerton because Lauren Brady for the Ingersoll Mets, he only gave up five hits, struck out six, had a walk, and they had a 2-1 win to take the series there. And Lauren had a couple of singles to help his own cause. And this was all after they had played a game in Ingersoll where Bob Bogdan had three hits for the Walkerton Merchants, but wasn't enough because Dan O'Neill and Paul Henderson had key hits for Ingersoll. And I'm pretty sure that's not the Paul Henderson we all know from the Summit series. And our Major League Clark Ives from 1964 comes from the Montreal Gazette, September 1st. And you can see for our TV viewers, the headline says Dodgers win 12-3. And in this game here, Don Drysdale had a couple of RBI singles to help his own cause, and he struck out 12 as they pasted the St. Louis Mets and ended their six-game winning streak. Maury Wills and Wes Parker had home runs, and that was a season where neither of them hit a whole lot of home runs. And, so Don Drysdale brought his record to 15-13, and his 12 strikeouts in the game brought a season total to 201, which put him right behind Sandy Koufax, who had 223, his teammate. But Sandy Koufax was injured at that point, so he was in line to take over the strikeout lead for that season. And so this loss left the Cards 7.5 games behind the Philadelphia Phillies, leaving them in fourth spot in the National League race. So there we go. That's the 1964 Clark Ives taking you back to Walkerton and to a game in St. Louis. I hope you enjoy that. If you want to read more about that, those are both posted on Twitter. You can find them at Andy Clark, at Gray County Guy, and they've been retweeted by Whiteman and by Blue Water Radio. So if you want to read more about those, if you saw some familiar names, if you're from the Walkerton area and want to relive the glory days, look it up on Twitter and enjoy. And so we're going to bring it back to our conversation about the playoffs.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you, Andy. And good job on Clark Ives. And I know a lot of fans are enjoying Clark Ives as well. I've had lots of nice comments about it, so keep up the good work on that. But yeah, let's talk about the American League East guys, Boston and New York Yankees. Lots of bad blood there. And both of them are playing extremely well right now. Boston holding that three-game lead, and they're 7-3 in their last 10, and the Yankees 8-2, trailing by three and trying to make up the ground in the few weeks that are left. And just generally, what are your thoughts on that particular race?
I think it's fun, number one. That's kind of the easy answer, right? Because they both have so many great players so many good moving pieces there. And I'm really fascinated to see how young Judge finishes the season. And you brought in, too, the aspect of the signal stealing and such. And I have to be honest. I'm not sure how I feel about that because stealing signals in baseball is ancient,
right? Kind of apropos for if you're not cheating, you're not competing is sort of the goal of some of these teams, I think, in trying to get an extra edge.
It's a very baseball thing too, right? Because, you know, when I grew up, we still had the Negro brothers and a whole bunch of other guys like that, Gaylord Perry and those fellas, and they were all throwing the spitter.
Yeah.
Whether it actually had spit on the ball or
Vaseline or whatever.
Yeah, they were doctoring it and stuff like that. Was it Phil or Joe, that whole comical clip?
It was both.
Yeah. Well, they both got nailed for it, but the one actually had the nail file on the mound.
I think it was Phil maybe with that one.
Phil, yeah. And I think he was with the Astros at that time.
Yeah, sounds right, yeah.
The umpire's coming out because someone actually had sort of seen what he was doing. And I'm like, how on earth can he be in the middle of a stadium with that many thousands of people in using a nail file to, you know, work on the ball? Like, it was just unbelievable to me.
The pitcher's mound is a far distance from the first row.
Yeah. And of course, if people know what I'm referencing on this clip, as the umpire was coming out to confront him, he kind of did this thing where he quick flipped it off the mound. You know, what me?
What
me?
What are you talking about?
No one would see this nail file flying through the air. But yeah,
I think if I could interrupt for a sec, I think the fact that they were using an Apple Watch, so they're kind of using technology to get the sign from the person who can see it to the people who actually need it immediately. Like, sign stealing is one thing, and I agree, it's been done for like maybe centuries in baseball. You know, the immediacy of getting it right there to the player who's on the field right there, it's going to make the very, very next play and not taking it back to the dugout and getting it the next inning. I think that's where it kind of cuts the line for me.
And it's very much akin to with the Patriots. And I know Patriots fans Absolutely. Are going to start groaning right now. But that whole Deflategate thing, people forget that that was predicated on the fact that they got caught dead to rights sending people to other teams' practices to film signals in practice, right? And a lot of teams were just like, yeah, that's kind of beyond the pale.
It's crossing the line big
yeah,
time. Yeah,
if you can steal signals during the game, it's one thing. But when you're sending people to practices with cameras, you know, so they had a bit of a legacy they were trying to live down when the whole Deflategate thing came along. But yeah, there's a lot of...
it's kind of fun watching that particular race, even though the Jays aren't in it, to see how it's gonna evolve and play out. I mean, the Central Division, it's over. Cleveland is so far ahead of anyone else with a 15-game lead there over the Minnesota Twins, who have had a good season, really, for them. Yeah. You know, Paul Molitor's got them straightened around, and they're 6 games over .500, which I think is pretty solid. But at the end of the day, Cleveland has shown to be superior. And then we go to the West, and, I mean, Houston started like a house on fire. And really, you know, I don't want to say they've come back to earth a little bit, because they've been playing, you know, not bad, but they just weren't able to sustain that level of play that they started with. And now they're only a game and a half ahead of the LA Angels. So they're 15 games ahead, but they're only a game and a half ahead when you look at the standings I'm trying to look here. They have a 6-11 win percentage, so they've fallen beneath Cleveland overall, and they've fallen beneath a couple of other teams in the National League as well. So, you know, for a team that was home and away, it looked like they were cooled out, the best team in baseball. It really hasn't evolved that way for them. And maybe, you know, when you look at how far behind some of their in their division other teams are, maybe they just lost interest in it a little bit, perhaps.
With such a long season, it's hard to sustain that high level, that hitting on all cylinders. But I would say that they're reloading, or have reloaded beautifully for the playoffs, because Justin Verlander is not only such a great pitcher, but I kind of get a sense that he's reinvigorated the whole sense of confidence and excitement around that team again.
Well, he's an elite player. So when you add an elite player to a group that's, you know, was generally excelling already, it certainly gives them a bit of a shot in the arm. He certainly had some success in his career. Cy Young Award winner a couple times, and, you know, just a linchpin to any kind of starting rotation. So you put him into your lineup when you're already doing well, it's a big boost for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah, a big theme that's come up when we've talked to a lot of baseball people, it came up today when we were talking to Sean Riley of the Intercounty Baseball League. He talked about how confidence is such a huge aspect of being successful in baseball.
Right.
And if you can add a Justin Verlander to a team that's already strong heading into the playoffs, that's like instant confidence. And it's kind of like with Boston, you know, with David Price back there, like, he's actually in the bullpen right now.
Crazy.
Yeah.
For $30 million a year.
Yeah.
It defies logic, really, of what's happened to David Price. But let's talk about the wild card race. I mean, there's the Yankees look like they've locked up one of those wild card spots, but there's a lot of battle for that second one. The Yankees with a 5-game lead. Minnesota holding down that second spot. That would be a huge feather in the cap of Paul Molitor if they can actually finish it off. But the LA Angels just a game and a half back. Seattle 4 games back. But it's probably going to come down to Minnesota and LA, it looks like, for who's going to win that.
Certainly. And going back to Paul Molitor there, he's really turned things around, because after last season...
They were horrendous last year.
Yeah, so he was on a bit of a hot seat, but I think he's reestablished his worth to that franchise again. So,
well, and we look back, of course, I think he's a Minnesota native as well, which is, you know, excellent for to have a Hall of Famer come home and have success with his hometown franchise. Although he's obviously he was known for playing with the Milwaukee Brewers, and of course won a World Series with the Toronto Blue Jays. But he is a Minnesota guy, And so it's nice to see that, you know, he's went home. He wanted to contribute to his hometown team, and he's done a real good job there. Not going to get manager of the year or anything, but you know what? Maybe in a future year, as that team evolves, he might be get that kind of consideration.
Quite possibly, yeah. And he's such a gamer. He knows the game inside and out, both technically and attitude-wise, if you look at from those aspects. So.
Absolutely.
Do you want to take a look at the National League?
Yeah, I was just going to flip over there. And so when you look at the division leaders, of course, are Washington, the Chicago Cubs, and the Dodgers. And right now, Arizona holding a 4.5 game lead for the first wild card. Colorado is hanging on to the second one by 2 games over Milwaukee. And you know what? I mean, Milwaukee, I mean, talk about a doormat franchise for a long time that maybe finally is getting things together here. They're 80-70. There's no shame in that. 10 games over 500, had a pretty credible year. They're in the hunt for that wild card spot. You know, just for their long suffering fans, you'd like to maybe see them pull it off.
Yeah, you know, it seems to my mind it's almost like going back to Kirby Puckett days to when they were last really Kirby was the Twins. I was thinking Cecil Cooper. Wrong reference there. Yeah.
Well, Robin Yountin and Molitor, yeah, really for Milwaukee is the glory days of the Milwaukee Brewers. We were just talking about Paul, yeah, and of course he was one of the stars on that particular team. Him and Robin Yount were the kind of the duo that led the way for them. But you're right, they haven't been good for a long time, and it's nice to see maybe they're back.
Yeah, and you know what? That's a relatively small market. They basically share it with the Green Bay Packers, yeah, right, and the Bucks. So they got to be good to compete with the love of the Green Bay Packers as far as marketing goes too. So with the Dodgers having their recent losing streak, is that a big shock or is that not a big deal?
I don't know. I guess we're going to see if they can get the ship righted again, but I'd be a little, I think it's a cause for concern, but maybe not complete abandonment by their fans. You know, things happen sometimes and circumstances are just not working out for them at the moment, but you can turn on a dime sometimes in this game. So I think it's a cause for concern, but I wouldn't panic if I was a Dodgers fan right now, but I'd be cautiously optimistic with what's going on there. What do you think about Marco Estrada? I mean, the Jays re-signed him this afternoon, or the rumor is they are re-signing him to a one-year deal worth approximately $13 million. I don't know if it's official yet, but there's lots of reports suggesting it's going to get done. What do you think about it?
$13 million is not terrible, given the market. It's a lot of money to the rest of us, but yeah, given the market, $13 million is not crazy. And you do need to have that pitching, and there's a hope there that he can be a solid inning muncher of a pitcher.
He has been before.
If he can return to form, then the $13 money's going to be well spent. But it is a risk. But I think as far as moves go, though, you have to. There's that confidence piece. If you can get that in place now, and then go look for more, I think it.
To interject from the control room, it is official now. A $13 million one-year contract extension for Estrada.
Okay,
became official about 5 minutes before our show started.
Well, there you go. So congratulations to Marco Estrada. You know what? I think there's limited risk in a one-year deal, obviously, in terms of, you know, you don't have to put 3 years into this situation. And I think on his side of the ledger, the 1 year gives him, you know, he's going to get paid very well, but he also, maybe if he has a great year, can make more down the line.
Be interesting to see how that plays out next season. That's all the time we have for today on Baseball Talk. So if you want to catch us, watch it Friday night on Whiteman Channel 6 at 8 o'clock. And we'll see you next week right here.
Baseball Talk is brought to you by Lasting Memories Locker Room, downtown Hanover, where you will find incredible sports memorabilia, art supplies, and custom framing. Check them out online at lastingmemorieslockerroom.com.
Thank you for watching Baseball Talk. Be sure to tune into the live show every Wednesday at 6 p.m. on 91.3 FM Blue Water Radio and watch the video replay every Friday night at 8 p.m. on Whiteman TV Channel 6.
The preceding program was brought to you by Whiteman TV and Bruce Telecom.